I'll make it a performance.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. I'm again Rob Coulter, joined by Nathan Cooper-Brown, Nick Mihai. Welcome, guys.
Good to see you, lads.
Thanks for having me, Robbie.
Big news this week, Ted Lasso back for season four.
It's happening.
It's coming at some stage. Going to make us wait like 8 years for it. I can see this coming, but you know, we'll take it. As a reminder to everyone, of course, on social media, you can find all the Talking Split podcasts, drills, everything along those lines. At Talking Split is the handle for that on Instagram, on YouTube, and on X. It's starting to go away from X a little bit, actually, of late. It's a bit of a weird place now. It's become very political, as it turns out. So I'm thinking we may shelve that one down the road, but we'll see how we end up with that. As a little bit of a reminder, coach shout-outs, if you do have anything, you are able to send those through, and we'll put those on the podcast. Funny story, I was knocking up all the stuff for the podcast yesterday, and Zoe was sitting next to me. I'm like, oh, we've run out of coach shout-outs. Like, you know, we've worked through the list. She's like, raged up at me. She's like, that is typical. The week I'm not on, where you play that ridiculous jingle music at the start of the pod, this is the week that you run out. It's like, yeah, a little unlucky, but I still like it.
Can I do a shout-out then? Is it
mate,
too late?
You
can
do one.
You know you make me wanna shout out my cold chairs, out my cold chairs, out my cold chairs. Come on now.
I can nearly guarantee he doesn't have one. He just wanted the music.
Yeah, absolutely. That one's for you, Zoe, if you're listening. Hopefully you are. No, I actually do have a shout out. So I did a community course not long ago for the Kunung Comets, I believe they are. And Prue, who is the general manager of the Kunung Comets, she was down there with them. And she just does an amazing job of getting around the community. She was there for the entire course from 7 o'clock at night till 9 o'clock at night. And closed
been
up
there
the
probably beforehand as well, doing some stuff with kids.
100%. And yep. And she was talking to me about, you know, I'm general manager, but I love to get around. So I just call up schools and I go down and run little camps and clinics. Like, there's not many general managers that are out at the front line coaching these kids and trying to educate and develop coaches as well. There were some coaches there that were 17, 18 years old, and she's getting them in early. And she just does a great job. And I thought she deserved a shout out for sure.
Big time. Made great use of the jingle as well, Nick. I thought you were leading me down a path there where it's like, you know, I just want you to play it for the sake of playing it. But what we are going to jump into today is, this is one of the questions we do get a lot of our coaching courses in particular, is how do we get the ball into the court? And it's a very valid point, because after the jump ball, a lot of good things can happen, but a lot of bad things can happen. Namely, you get scored on. And at some point, you will need to inbound the ball, whether it be off a baseline, whether it be off a sideline, whether it be after a score. And it is just one of those areas that I think, regardless of the level, and it is, look, to be fair, I think it is more of a junior problem than a senior problem. Like, most senior teams can kind of figure that out without too many issues. But is there a reason that you've seen, Coops, that a lot of our teams do struggle to actually get the ball in court?
Many, many, many.
Okay, strap in.
Yeah, probably maybe fire off a list and we can go into a couple. Yeah, we can start with some of probably the more junior, maybe bad habits, for lack of a better term, but, you know, inbounding underneath the backboard. Yeah. So, you know, you're immediately taking away a longer pass. Not running the baseline after a make to improve, you know, a passing angle. Not working on the ability to effectively lead and get open, and how you can use that, you know, in the backcourt on a baseline or a three-quarter court inbound. Inbounders not playing in a stance and pivoting and faking like, you know, they would anywhere else, you know, standing maybe upright or putting the ball above their head, so limiting passing angles. And then, you know, we can get into more like scheme-based stuff around, you know, effective press break or effective, you know, inbound tactics and how that builds shape. Yep. After that,
Nick and I are just laughing at you. It's like you've just triggered a whole lot of trauma for me from like coaching under 12s for so many years.
I was laughing more that it feels like it's been on his mind a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's bang, ready to go. Yep, this is what I've got.
There was no pre-planning in this whatsoever. Coop's just had this like front of mind as you're going through it. But as junior coaches, we go through all of those things. Mm. And like, I remember coaching an under 12s team one year. It's like, hey, you can run the baseline after a score. And it was mind-blowing to those kids. It's like, what? Like, when did this become a rule? But then, you know, vintage my luck, as you know, ripped off Rob is really a thing. And one of my kids ran the baseline, got called for a travel. I'm like, the kid looks at me straight away like, you have sold me down the river on this thing. Like, you have told me I can do this. I'm like, okay, I did. I didn't tell the ref they could do that. And they didn't quite understand the rule at the same time. The ref was like 15. It's like, buddy, like, it's... I get it, but, you know, can we just allow it after a score? And he's like, look, to be honest, I forgot they scored. I thought it was just an out of bounds and he couldn't move. I'm like, yeah, we're good. Don't worry about it. And it's like, can you just tell the kid that just to make sure that they know that I wasn't the idiot?
Was that the same response you had when you got in the car afterwards? Or
similar. But it is one of those things that is kind of a cheat code, I think, for a lot of teams, that they don't actually understand that you can run that baseline after a score just to improve the angle. Like, we do all this work and we almost sort of see the dancing of people trying to get open. They don't actually get open, but that ability to change the angle is such a big part of it. And it is something you actually have to teach. Because I think for mine, a part of it too is their ability to get the ball out of the net. And it is almost like this catastrophic problem when we get scored on. It's like everyone drops their heads and woe is me. And, you know, I got back cut on. Yeah, but I let the pass get there. And, oh, no. You know, the ball bounces two or three times. So the D gets a chance to get set up. Like, just that ability to get the ball out of the net, jump up, grab it, get a step out and get the ball going again. That's kind of the key for mine. Like, it's just how you get the ball back into the court.
Yeah, for me, it's a different, slightly different view. I think it's time constraints. So coaches prioritize the 70% of basketball, the transition onto offense and defense. So they kind of, I wouldn't say neglect, but they kind of miss sometimes the inbounds pass of it because they're starting it in a certain scenario. My advice to that is to incorporate it. Just add that layer in. So they're working on it. Like, don't use it as an excuse, because I get it. Some coaches have an hour of practice and they're like, I can't work on an inbounds play or passing the ball in. But you can absolutely incorporate it into your scrimmages, and you should be playing scrimmages at some point in that hour practice.
Yep. And it is something I've got listed for later, to be honest, in the pod, is like baseline, sideline stuff. But think about how many of those you get per game. Like, realistically, you might get three baselines and three... When I say sidelines where you could run a set to get into something, to get you something, you're going to get scored on far more often than six times. So realistically, when you look at bang for buck, the bang for buck is getting the ball out of the net and going straight away rather than, you know, pretty baseline sideline plays. So I think for mine, that's where I'd probably invest more of my time, is can your players actually, and I mean, this is a legitimate thing, can you finish, whether it be like a little layup drill or a game or something like that, where the end part is not the ball going through the net. The end part is grabbing the ball out of the net, taking a step out of court, firing the ball in and going from there. There's ways to incorporate it, I think.
Going on to our first tangent.
Always good.
Yeah. So
inside 8 minutes.
I was going to say, I was trying to break the record. Last night at SPP, you know, we've spoken a lot on the pod about free throw shooting and, you know, how can you incorporate genuine pressure free throws, and, you know, how do we work on that because it's so hard to replicate. One of the things that we've started, so last night we would start a possession, and whether that's one possession, you know, full court, or we're down and back, whatever it may be, we would start it with a free throw so we can incorporate a pressure free throw, and then obviously we go into our inbound and then playing into our flow. And then what we do with the free throw is if you make it, you get plus 1 point for your team. But if you miss it, it's minus three.
Jeez, it's brutal.
Yeah, that's harsh.
Yeah.
Sending a clear message there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, let's face it, it is. Like, free throw shooting across the board, and, you know, I'll continue down this tangent for you if you like, has been fairly poor over the last number of years. But it is probably the single most relatable and comparable skill that we've had in the sport over... I mean, we can't talk about scoring averages because the three-point line wasn't necessarily in for part of our history as a sport. So that's a little bit skewed. The free throw line is always where it has always been, has always been a part of the game, but our numbers continue to decline for some reason. That doesn't make sense. Like, look, for mine, it can only be that we don't practice it anywhere near enough in our own time. Like, it's, you know, we see all these kids go to gyms and go and do workouts and all that sort of stuff, and they're very happy to spin the ball out to themselves, catch it and fire off threes. But standing on the free throw line, clearing their head, you know, getting to a point where they can actually make a shot, you know, that's not really the sexy stuff they want to be involved with.
No, it's not. And we get it. You know, everyone's got time constraints, court space constraint. But, you know, we're talking about inbounding, but all of a sudden we've added a pressure free throw and an inbound scenario in, what, an extra 4 seconds?
Yep.
You know, we're just lining up, we're shooting one free throw that has pressure on it. We've got to inbound the ball. We've got to, you know, bring the ball up against some defense, find our shape and you know, execute something, obviously, if our focus is on the offensive side of the ball. So It's just building on Nick's point, is that there's ways in which you can incorporate more time in inbound scenarios, in practice.
Yeah, and it's – I hear the complaints about, hey, I only get half a court. Well, there's still ways you can do that. Like, you can still make it that way where free throw, inbound, play it to half court. That might be like your sideline break, for argument's sake, where catch it, pitch it ahead, and from there you play back on that position. It can still be done. Like, there's ways to manipulate this, and that's one challenge I would have for the coaches. Is like, even if you just jump on the Talking Split Instagram or YouTube stuff, there is nothing but 2-on-1, 3-on-2 games in there to play. So play those. Like, if that's what you want to get to, like, get it to free throw, inbound, play out of, and find your shape and go from there. I think there's ways to do it. And, you know, whether you have 10 players at your practice, whether you have 6 players at your practice, there's always time to get more drill out of the drill. Like, I think that's something that we can work on. And sometimes it doesn't have to look pretty. And sometimes it doesn't have to look like the game would make it look like. Sometimes you're just working on a skill. And that's okay. Like, it's, you know, I would consider myself a small-sided games person. But it doesn't necessarily mean that everything has to look like the game. Whilst you're doing that, you can still manipulate some things along the way. Like, we do two-ball dribbling. But, you know, you don't have two balls in a game. So you got to try and find different ways to get your point across to the players. And the scoring system, which I really like, of +1 but -3, well, I'd almost go the other way. It's like, you don't get any points for making it. It's like, it's expected.
Yeah,
that should be just the standard. Because it's almost like we're rewarding it for, hey, good job, you made a free throw. And it's like, no, we expect you to make a free throw at 90-something percent plus.
I'm loving how dark this pod's getting.
Yeah, early on.
Yeah.
And it went straight to free throws.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, it didn't even deviate.
Coops brought a little bit of trauma in from last night's session, as it turns out.
It's written on his hand, I can see. It's like passing problems, free throw. Got it.
Is there a reason we see like more structured presses at the junior level than we do at the senior level, Nick? Like, I mean, you're obviously involved with NBL space. Look, we would see very few structured presses in the senior level. Is there a reason for that, do you think?
I just think the basketball IQ and skill level means that they can sort of figure it out at that stage. Like, they get put in positions, but they know how to not fall into corners and get trapped, and they know they can run the baseline and stuff. So I think for a junior level, that's why it has to be more structured. Also, the limitations of the players, right? So they're a little bit more one-dimensional at that age. They haven't added layers to their game, so they have to be put in certain positions as well as they move through. I think they're the biggest differences that I've seen as well.
Yep. Coops, do you see, like, you watch a lot of international basketball, obviously, do you see much of the sort of structured presses up the floor that would cause problems to get the ball in?
Depends on the level. Yep. You can see in smaller market countries or smaller market teams that they want to do things differently, and you'll see them press more and try and be a little bit more innovative and disruptive in that way. Bigger teams, less. But again, you know, you it's kind of what Nick's talking about, you know, bigger, stronger, more skilled athletes, better decision makers. You know, a press, as we know, is high risk, high reward. And so when the higher you go, when you know, basically every possession matters. You know, how many possessions are you willing to risk because of a press?
And then, like, you remember the Perth Wildcats team, going back a little bit now. So Damian Martin was playing, Matty Knight was playing with them. There was a young Sean Redditch, as opposed to the version we've got at the moment, who is somehow still playing.
Still like, good.
And good. And still good. That's quite impressive. Like, I think it was Trevor Gleeson coaching that team. It might have been the end of Bevo into Gleeson. Like, they were really good at, like, that 1-2-1-1 full court. Like, after a free throw, they had a knack of it. And, like, Redditch would read that thing on the front line and just take up some space. They just had a great knack of speeding teams up. But also, remember when they went and played one of the NBA games, I think they might have played Utah or something like that. They went to that press and it was off real quick because those players are just like buzzsaws. Like, it just goes up another level again.
Yeah.
So it is one of those things where presses do work at the junior level, but you're almost playing into the, I don't want to say insecurities, but like the lack of skill set and development that has gone into players by that stage, because they just haven't had the time and the IQ to, or the physical ability to not be pressed and not be trapped.
I think the physical part is the biggest part. Like, the amount of videos I see of like under 12s, where they're playing against a full court 1-2-2 press or a 1-2-1-1 or whatever, they're not going to get through it. Like, they might have the IQ and know how to do it, but they can't physically get through it. until they're older. So, like, I would highly advise if you're doing those presses, like, to give those players a chance in the future. Play full court man-to-man. Teach them how to shade the ball to the sideline. Teach them how to deny the kick ahead. That stuff, it's the, you know, I'm taking Durham's speech here, but it's the broccoli of basketball. Like, it's boring, but it's, like, super good for you as well. So, I think it's very hard to give advice for those young coaches with those young age groups on how to inbound the ball when they can't physically do it either.
Yeah. Piggybacking on that, I remember watching the Spanish team at the 2022 under-17 World Cup, and their press break was basically like a full court four corners. Yep. And they would inbound and, you know, the guards would share it, but basically a guard would get it in the backcourt and look at a full court diagonal overhead pass. And just that, like,
just because.
Yeah, they were just these big European guards, and they would just snap the ball basically and throw it over the top of the press because they could.
Yep.
You know, and if you've got the means to break it that way, then why wouldn't you?
Well, that is, I mean, strength, and you both hit on it, strength is a big part of it. Like, when we're dealing with literally 9 and 10 year old kids, of course they're going to struggle with the physical ability to pick a ball up, whether it be one hand, two hand, overhead, underhand, chest pass, whatever. They physically cannot get it there on time and on target. And that's why I think you see so many of those presses at the junior level, because they are playing into the lack of development that has happened at that point. But there's a reason you don't see them as they get older.
Well, there's a real correlation. Like, and we've all been around it. Like, the amount of kids that come into our program or through our program, obviously it's better now as we're addressing through more and more strength and conditioning, but how poor their push-up technique is.
Yep.
Their inability to do one correct push-up. And basically, what is a push-up mimicking? A two-handed chest pass. Yep. So if you can't functionally do that movement, then you're probably going to struggle to be able to snap a pass, you know, to the place that it needs to get to.
On that as well, does anyone remember when that young Lithuanian team came to the Dandy Eltham tournament?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah.
What a pleasure it was to watch 12 and 13 year olds who look like they were pretty strong. They all played similar positions. This is a tiny country where we're all trying to figure out how they're just mass producing all these players. And we figured out why. And do you remember they lost that game to go into the grand final because they got pressed? And I can't remember which coach it was, but he asked him, he's like, you know, how'd you get, was that you, Rob?
I don't know. It wasn't me.
It wasn't you? I don't know who it was.
I understand why you'd think I was the jerk that would press an international team. No, I mean
the coach who asked him afterwards.
No.
But asked him, like, you know, you don't work on your press. He goes, we work on man-to-man skills. We work on their body. We work on passing, dribbling, and inbounding. And then he goes, but give me a week and I'll get through that press.
Yeah.
It was such a good answer. So good.
It's accurate, but it's funny because it was just during the week. I was just doing a little bit of doom scrolling because I had nothing better to do, as it turned out. But it was a clip of, hey, this is the sort of pass you'll only see in European junior basketball. And it was literally a kid just like taking one dribble and throwing an underhand scoop pass like three quarters of the court. And it's like, yep, bang on the money. Like, you don't see that anywhere else. Like,
I love that. You know, we don't. That at all.
Yeah, yeah, like, so we, it's crazy, the level. And look, it hits the roof. Like, it goes up rather than out.
I've got a cool one, actually. That I read about as well. It wasn't on X, so it was. This is one. Okay, I'll stay on topic. But in Spain, for the younger kids, when the ball goes out of bounds for their development, the ref doesn't take the ball and hand it back to them. They just inbound it like soccer to teach them pressure and be able to pass the pressure.
Yeah.
Yep. It's also probably a defensive thing, like you've got to stay on the move. Yep. Very clever to incorporate another sport's rules to help progress their game.
So we did that. So the under 12 Jamboree has always been the Jamboree in country basketball, and it's been there for years and years and years. The first year that Metro did something, they called it a showcase instead. So that was when Mike Zeppel was in the role, and, you know, the size 5 basketball, the inside 3-point line where they brought it in a little bit. And one of the rules was when the ball goes out of court, no ref touch. The speed that game played at was out of control, and it's amazing how adaptive the kids got at making passes, because now it wasn't, I have to stand here with the ball on my rib cage and just, you know, pivot with my eyes to try and find someone. It was now, hey, I'm going to try and get that over there, but there are two people standing in the way. How can I get it there? Well, I'm going to just throw this overhand, like Shane Warne leg break, to try and get it there. And it did. Like, so when I start thinking like adaptive passing and how you actually teach adaptive passing, because there are, I go back and forth on this, because there's an element of you'll do a drill or a little small-sided game where it's like, hey, it's 2-on-1, but if you throw a behind-the-back pass, that gets you an extra point. And it's like, well, are you almost being too prescriptive now by giving them the extra point for throwing something that's a little bit adaptive in there? But you almost need to give them permission to do it first so that then they will try it, because they won't try it unless you almost bring it to their attention as to, hey, this is actually a viable option. Don't feel like, you know, this is the fancy pass and you're trying to be tricky. No, it's just the pass to get the ball from where it needs to get to and however you need to get it there.
Yeah. Would you go straight into the mess? And what I mean by that is, you know how we have our stationary passing back and forth? Yep. Would you teach it there to pass outside your body and behind the back and then go into live?
Or for just sure. Yeah, it's a mess anyway. Yeah. Like anyone that's watched junior basketball recently would know that, you know, wherever the ball is, there will be 10 players within about a 4 to 5 foot radius of wherever that ball is. So teach them to play in the mess. Like the earlier they can see that mess, the more they'll have to adapt and try and work out different ways to do it.
Yeah, for me, lately, especially, you know, after Worlds and Japan, has been the impact of the defense to create better passes, the impact of the defense to create better guards and better ball handlers. And it's just really starting to ramp that up and giving the defense a little bit more license to, you know, maybe get blown by a little bit more, but blown by is probably not the right language, getting beat, because we're so up and in and we're so physical. Like last night, you know, we started with some, with 20 minutes of toughness. So we did like ball tug of war, and then we did ball tug of war into, so if you won the ball out of the tug of war, you had to pivot and fake for 4 seconds while the other player like fouled and grabbed and tried to get the ball back. So obviously we were kind of pivoting and protecting the ball. We did old school full court 1-on-2. And we started that from an inbounds pass.
Yep.
You know, we worked on 2-on-2, but it was really prescriptive around what the offense was allowed to do. So the defense knew exactly what they were going to do. So it was heavy denial, heavy ball pressure. You know, a player had to drive. When they drove, they weren't allowed to score. So, you know, the defense, again, could be really manipulative around what they were taking away. And the offense had to figure it out. They had to figure it out through a jump stop. They had to figure it out through an outside cylinder pass and so on. And that's something that I'm really enjoying and feel like I'm going to carry through, as we try and develop better passes and better ball handlers is using the defense.
Yep.
I'm going to go on the second tangent here.
Oh, okay.
Early. Just quickly. Okay. Mm. Yeah, it is very early.
Yeah, 23 minute mark.
23 minute. closeouts. Mm. So I've heard, and just, correct me if I'm wrong, that the stutter step before you close out is being taken away and it's just get there at that high level. If that is correct, should that be taught with our under 12s? Should that be taught at domestic level? And can you explain what get there is if that is the case as well?
Yeah, correct. It is. Yep, we've taken that away. No longer choppy steps. The main reason being international basketball shooters or professional shooters are so good. As soon as you start chopping your steps, that's basically an uncontested three. Like you think about the shots that Goulding has been making, you know, in the playoffs and now this final series. Could you afford to chop your feet before getting to that guy? Like no
they
way.
Might foul him a bit less if they did.
Yeah.
Like that's probably the counter argument to it, is that you may put yourself in a position to foul a little bit more, but you've got to contest it too.
That's right. And that's why there's a lot, you know, a lot more teaching around flyby closeouts that we know is happening a lot.
Yep. Just explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, so that's where we're actually like running at and jumping to contest or disrupt the shot and actually like jumping past the shooter, so that they have to do something else but get the shot off. And obviously that's more higher level, but you know, you hear about that a lot in the NBA about flyby closeouts. But no, you're spot on, Nick, is that the choppy steps are gone. We need to do it because we have to take away the rhythm three. We also want to be better at closing down the space. You know, as we know, offense is spacing is offense. So even the choppy steps on a short closeout is going to give athletes enough time and space to be able to manipulate it and you know, create a split and so on. So the quicker we can take away the rhythm three, the quicker we can get body to body and take away a straight line drive, that's going to be better for us. Yeah, great question. How do we get there? Like for me, with things like that, like, you know, a long closeout, which is basically the hardest thing to do, yeah, in the game as an individual, probably outside of shooting. How do you get there? Get there. You know, I'm getting less about technique and more about execution. So if you need to jump, you know, take a little hop, or you need to, you know, just stick it in a stride stop, 1-2 or whatever it may be, I'm all for it as long as you get the job done. Because who is it, you know, for me, the old crippled guy who, you know, got close to making it to tell you exactly how to do it when you're guarding a 6'7", you know, USA athlete who...
Shooting guard,
yeah, who's like can jump eye level to the rim, but can also shoot 40% from three. Nah, do it this way. It's like, no, you do it how you need to do it to get the job done.
And the get there part is actually interesting to me, because it does make sense, because if they contain the ball and they take away the shot, do you really care how they got there?
Not one bit. Like, not you think about bit. All the teaching we've done over the years, of, you know, don't cross your feet over and all those sorts of things. And
point the foot.
Yeah. Heel toe as you go through it. It's like, yeah, maybe we really sort of screwed up a little bit of a generation there by sort of making them do something they weren't comfortable at.
Yeah.
Like it's, I mean, you think about the coordination and the physical literacy of a lot of our players too, to be able to move around. Like it's, I'll tell you one player I've really enjoyed watching this sort of playoffs and final series, Dave O'Hickey. Have really enjoyed how he's been played, but really enjoyed what he's contributed to the team as well. I feel like he's the sort of guy that if you tried to give him too many teaching points and we need you to do this way and this is the only way to do it, you'd actually make him worse. Whereas if you can lean into what he's really good at, which is being that explosive, dynamic athlete that plays on instinct, that just goes at everything at 110%, you get the best out of him. And that's where I sort of bounce back and forwards with what really matters and what's nice to have but doesn't really matter that much. And it's, you know, he's a great example, I think, of a player that just has worked out what he's great at and leans into that. You know, is he in stance every time? No. But does he still get plenty of steals? Yes. Does he contain the ball? Yes. So do I really care if he's in stance? Not particularly. Like, it's, you still want that sort of... You know, you want some things that you're not going to move on, but I think for someone like that just plays so well instinctively, why make it harder when they're, you know, trying to worry about, has my heel crossed over my toe on the other? Like, who cares?
He's absolutely like that. Like, I was on a coaching staff when he was on the team,
yep.
And less is definitely more. It frees him up, right?
Yep.
We need you to get to A and B, but everything else you can figure out. And just his instinct, like you said, and his athleticism combined makes him so impactful, and he was really good against us.
Yeah, sorry to bring it up, Nick, but
you know, I think I did by accident there. Yeah.
I tried to rewind it, but
yeah, that was your fault, not ours.
We'll cut that out anyway.
So, I mean, when we're talking the teams that struggle, like, are we talking skill set or are we talking structure? Like, inbounding the ball in particular, like, do we go down the path of, hey, you need to have a press breaker, or is there any point in having a press breaker if they can't do the basic skill stuff anyway?
Well, this for me comes back to the periodization and understanding your season and understanding your athletes, and importantly, understanding your job as a junior coach. Number one priority, help them foster a love for the game. Second is help them become better. But we understand, like, especially talking to our VJBL coaches, you know, especially the ones that are ones and twos, you know, that are trying to, you know, get to the best level available, and they've got pressure from DOCs and those sorts of things. In grading, yes, scheme is going to help you. Having a really good press break that's going to allow your athletes to have success, break the cheat code of, you know, early presses and presses against, you know, smaller, you know, younger athletes. Yep, smart. Get it in early, make sure that that's a part of it. As soon as you make your league, and again, let's say it's VC or Division One, as soon as you make your league, you should be going back to the skill set. Yep. How do you pivot to pass? How do you fake a pass to make a pass? How do you use both sides of your body? How do you pass outside your cylinder? How do you snap a pass? How do you create space from the guy guarding you with the basketball to open up a passing lane? Like, those things have to be addressed. You can't just rely on scheme.
Yep, and it's, I mean, you say good press break. Good press break does not necessarily need to be complicated.
No.
Like it can be as simple gets. Does it get the ball in? Yes. Does it provide you with two or three passing options? Yes. It's a good press breaker. That's what it needs to be. Like there's nothing more than that.
Yeah. Story time, Rob.
Surprise.
Is this going to be on brand or is this on tangent?
No, no, it's actually pretty good. Okay, actually, good. I think, you were there with the meeting. So we caught up recently with the great Mike McHugh. And he was talking about, he was running one of the community courses, was it? Or club? He was running a club for us. Yep. And he said that a young coach for under 12s came up to him and said, look, I'm having really a lot of problems with my sideline inbounds play. I'm struggling to get them open and stuff. And he goes, wait, how old are they? And he goes, well, you know, under 12, so 10 or 11. He goes, teach them to pass, teach them to catch, and you'll probably solve 90% of your problems. And
classic the, Mike, love it.
Classic
love
Mike, it. Very simple, yeah. But he does have a very good point. At those younger groups, the under 12s, instead of focusing on the big picture of my execution of my offense isn't perfect to get the ball inbound and the press break, teach them to pass, teach them to catch. A lot of the time, teach them to catch through traffic, for example, like they're leading towards the ball. It's a lot of what they do in footy, right? They teach them to kick and they teach them to catch and they teach them to handball.
Yeah.
They have those skills and they build on that.
Well, and I mean, the toughness drills you were talking about before, Coops, that's a big part of it. How many players actually catch the ball, then get monstered by two people, and it's like, geez, I've got to now work out where I can get to without dragging a pivot foot, without turning the ball over. Can I get some? And they go into that, you know, little like safety armadillo type role, whether it's
or
like,
back we're to just the gonna, defender, yeah, so they can't see anything. Yes.
Like yeah. They can't do anything now. They're catching it in a corner, facing the baseline. The only person they can see is the inbounder, who is usually still standing out of court. They go, oh, that's my safety. They throw it back to him. It's like, oh, this is not ideal. So you do have to be really careful too that the skill set does matter. Like it's that ability to pass outside the body, as you're talking about, the ability to catch on the move. Because I've always had that thing of I don't want you catching the ball with your feet facing the baseline, like where it's just come from. Like I don't want that angle of a pass because I feel like by the time you catch it, stop your momentum, then turn and play, we've probably lost 2 or 3 seconds and we've missed 2 or 3 cutters. So I've always been really big on catch the ball on the move, preferably on that sort of sweep through so that you can catch it. The first movement is a forward pivot where you now look down the sideline. That should always be your first option. For mine is, can I kick the ball ahead? If I can't, can I find the middle? If I can't, can I find my trailer? And that's always been sort of my thing. That's made infinitely harder, of course, when you have a lot of teams that will face guard the first cut. Because I think most press breaks would start the same way, which is two people stand at the elbows. Whoever's the closest to the inbounder will go and screen away. That person will curl, then the person will come back to the ball, or the screener will come back to the ball and open up. Of course, coaching comes into this and people are like, well, okay, the person who is supposed to be guarding the inbounder, just face guard and just take that away, and that's hard. So now you've got a little bit of the byplay that comes into it. Like I remember like catch fakes being a thing, obviously with back cuts and those sorts of things, but you almost need that when you're breaking presses as well. Like that defender that can't see the ball coming, throw up a little catch fake, get them moving and then come back to the ball. That change of pace and change of direction and your ability to almost sell the story, like the Ted Lasso clip, Zoe was pumped with that one because I said, hey, we need a little drop at the start of the podcast. She's like, I've got it. Like it's, but it is, it's selling the story of, hey, I'm going to get the ball, but you may not be getting the ball, but you're dragging two defenders so that somebody else can get the ball. Mm. That's a big part of it. So you've almost got to sell the story with, I'm going to get the ball in this sort of space because, you know, again, for mine, I don't want them catching in corners. I do want them seeing up the floor. And I want them always thinking there are three passes, down the line, middle, trailer. They're the three that I'm after in particular. Now, who inbounds the ball? You know, that's, for mine, that's a bit of a raffle. I've always been closest person gets it and figure it. Again, it's similar to the get there, figure it out. Like, if I'd rather have two people try and inbound the ball than none, where it just gives the defense time to set up their inbound. So I've always been a first person to get there, gets it. Like, are you any different, Nick?
I had a group. So I had designated people that would get down the floor. Yep.
Some people you trusted and some people you didn't.
These are the three that I know won't turn over the ball. Yep. Yeah, it was a bit like that. Not quite like that. It was more, it takes a bit longer for the bigs to get down the floor, so I'm letting them go. But everyone else, you know, close to the ball, inbounds. And, you know, in most cases it got to a point in the season where it was a specific person because it just, they were smart enough. They were the easiest turnovers, and it's the worst place you can lose the ball, right, in the backcourt after a score because there's no D-trans, there's no space for it.
So. Yep. What about you, Coops? You any different?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one and something that's like really impacted my coaching over the last couple of years. Because we originally, especially through Country Victoria and the type of athletes that we have, you know, a lot of guards, a lot of speed. We've spoken about the value of playing with pace and how could we generate more of that. And one of the ways was to try and catch more teams napping after they made baskets. So to just get the ball in quick and could we get some cheap scores on makes. And so to do that, we changed our inbound rules and we said the closest person inbounds, and that could be the point guard. Yep. It was closest person inbounds. They needed to clear the backboard by sprinting the baseline. The next closest ball handler naturally became the point guard. If they started in the middle channel, they would sweep towards the sideline. If they start on the sideline, they'd sweep into the middle. And obviously the baseline runner would need to run with that player to improve the passing angle. There's a rule, and we still have this rule now, is you cannot inbound the ball across the split line. Yep. One, it's a poor passing angle. Two, if it does get stolen and you're stepping in as the defender, if you've passed across the split line, you're stepping into the halo, so you've got no ability to defend the ball. So we did that, and it was we've had some real success. Probably one of the best things that we had success with was more about generating a what's next mentality than being able to keep the scoreboard ticking over after makes. Because once teams realize what you're doing, they tend to just flood back in D-trans and they kill it off pretty quick. But the what's next mentality of like giving up a basket, being like, stuff it, we'll figure that out later, like let's go play some offense, was really, really good. Took that into the Crocs. And had some success early on, especially through Asia, but then it came back and bit us in Turkey, and famously in our game against Italy. Doing that, there was a costly turnover that helped us lose that game, and obviously dropped to the bottom part of the draw. And you know, those sorts of risks have contributed to, I'm sure I'm okay in saying this, but I didn't get the job again. And so that's obviously incredibly disappointing, because I would have loved another opportunity to better our standing after that performance in Turkey, and how much I love representing my country and coaching with that group. But I wish the new coaching staff nothing but the best. But that high risk, high reward, playing with pace, didn't work in that environment. And coming back, we've actually just changed our structure to now have the four-man inbound after a make.
Yep, so it's a rule now throughout whole programs?
The whole program, is that after a make, the four-man inbounds. And if you watch the NBL, if you watch the NBA, like that's a very typical rule, because it immediately builds early shape, 4-out, 1 in.
Yep.
And gives you that option of kicking ahead or playing through the four man and being able to get into potentially some two man action on the weak side of the floor. But obviously, by doing that, you're now changing the tempo of the offense, because the four man could be running from
anywhere.
Yeah, you know, there could be 2 or 3 seconds between the make and the inbound, which is obviously time for the defense to set up. So now we have actually had to start talking more about our ability to lead and get open against a set defense, our ability to run the baseline and improve passing angles. Yep. So it's definitely forcing us to play a different way and come back to some of the skill set stuff that we didn't have to worry about as much when we were trying to play faster.
What are the pros and cons you've seen so far? Like, it's probably small data, but what have you seen so far? Noticeable changes, obviously, other than the pace, by putting the four to always inbound the ball as opposed to anyone.
Yeah, one of the biggest benefits is more of a controlled offensive possession, you know, that we're not sped up. We know what we're running. We have shape. We're going to be able to use concepts. Obviously, the double-edged sword of that, again, is you're playing against a set defense. But we look more controlled. We just look we look better, and we're taking better shots, although – you know, they may be more, not necessarily contested, but they may be tougher shots, and maybe we could generate playing faster, but they're shots that lend themselves more to our strengths rather than just anybody taking a quick shot because we're trying to play fast after a make. So that's been a good one. And then the other one is also that it's actually shown our deficiencies in how to inbound against a more set defense. Yep. So that we are actually addressing, like, the big one at the moment is the ability to lead. That's yep. the one that we've had to go back and say, hey, arm and a leg over the top, sit on it, you know, strong arm, long arm, release when the ball's in the air. We're not trying to get into that coffin corner. You know, we're yep. trying to make sure that we can get into space. Preferably, we're still sweeping. Like, that's yep. still plan A, and we want to do exactly what you're saying, Rob, is sweep, catch, long pivot, see the kick ahead. If not, maybe rip or be able to attack through different spaces. But, yeah, like, it's a much more traditional way of playing, and it's not something that I thought I was going to go back to anytime soon, because I like innovating, I like trying different things. But yeah, I touched the stove and the stove was hot, so so I feel like I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, parenting 101.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So we're back to a more traditional way of playing. Yep. and we'll see how that goes in the coming months. Yeah,
and it's not a bad thing, it's just different.
Yeah,
and I mean, you know, you might have a group down the road where it's like, actually, you know, we probably can go back to it, and that's, you know, part of what coaching is, adapt to what you have in front of you. There might be some teams out there that have one point guard, and there might be some teams that have zero bigs, in which case you got to try and work out, well, do I still want it to be the four? Do we even have a four? Like, it's those types of things too, because I know over the years, because I was certainly a four-man inbounds the ball, and I kind of went away from it a little bit, because at a four-man I didn't necessarily trust one of those years, and it's like, well, look, yes, you will be inbounding the ball, but I don't love how this is working out. And anyone can do this now. Don't feel obliged to let him do it all the time. Like, it's... You know, you got to just try and change it a little bit. But what he was elite at was grabbing the ball out of the net, taking a step out, and his vision would be like head on shoulder straight away. Is there someone running that I can potentially find? And trying to throw that mass, like, baseball pass outlet. And it's like, well, I don't want to take that away either. Like, their ability to try and play quick and try and get the ball ahead, I actually really liked. It was just the execution that wasn't brilliant. But the kid was 11. So, of course, it wasn't going to be brilliant. Like, you're going to have a... sort of like golf, you know, rarely does it go where you want it. There's usually a fair channel where it could end up if things go slightly awry. So it is one of those things. You might need to have some rules with your team. There might be some that you genuinely don't want. Like, I could understand if you didn't want your five inbounding the ball because you want them on the rim run early. So that makes sense from a structural perspective. But in your point early, Coops, about the physicality and your ability to arm and leg over the top, that doesn't go away. And I think that is one of the biggest things to really impress upon coaches here is you got to get your players okay with being physical in this space. And it is usually the person who is physical first that gets away with it, and it's usually the person that's physical second that doesn't get away with it. But it is an area I think that our kids have got to be a little bit more okay with, is that basketball is not a non-contact sport. There will be contact. We have to be okay with the fact that there's contact. And if you make contact first in a legal manner, don't be throwing haymakers, obviously, but it is one of those areas where you have to get open, and you won't be able to get open if there is never any contact between the two.
It's funny, this pod's about inbounding the ball, but we're focusing more on the receiving and how to receive it.
Yep.
That will straight away improve your inbounds passing straight away, that the receiver can catch the ball. I always found, and I have no data on this, maybe you do, Rob, because I think you've spoken to me about this before,
I made up the data. I do tend to make up about 86% of my statistics.
If you can reference this made up data again, that'd be great. But it was about...
people can use data to prove anything. 78% of people know that.
That was not a play thing on
no, Rob's Richard. That was Coops. Just,
just so everyone knows. multi-sport athletes... Kids who play footy just knew how to make contact because they were taught it in footy, you know. And I'm not saying, hey, just everyone just start taking up multiple sports, but it does help. I have seen better rebounders, better hands. They're able to make contact and keep themselves steady. I don't know what they're teaching in footy. Obviously, it's part of the sport to stay on your feet, but it definitely translated into basketball.
Yeah, and there was even some stuff because I was going down the soccer path. The other football, Nick, as it's called, where
the real football. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to say that because we upset some of our.
You knew you wanted to. Yeah, you could just
but,
see it.
But now that you have, yeah, sure, yeah. The real football, where there was a kid kicking a ball against the wall, and all he was working on was his first touch and his movement out of the catch and out of the receiver. So effectively, he'd just fire that thing at the wall; it would come rifling back at him, and his next movement was, can I get it on the turn without having to like stop and prop? It was scanning, which we talk about a lot, obviously, but knowing which way to turn and what that movement felt like. And the way that sort of laid out was he'd fire it at the wall, it had come back, and he'd have one of his mates sitting behind him, and he had to check over his shoulder, which way are they playing? Can I make contact first? Do I have to make contact with them, or can I come and receive it without contact? And what's my first movement look like out of it? And it kind of got me thinking. It's like, well, maybe we need to do a little bit of that with our players in particular. Like, and I'm only just making this up as I'm talking through it. Could you have a person on the baseline as your inbounder? Could you have offense and defense standing at half court, for argument's sake, lead towards the ball in just a straight line? Passer has to work out which side of the body is the defense playing. Then you can work out, like, okay, if the ball's coming to my left hand, then I know the defense must be on my right side. Can I now catch and sweep through and play? And it's almost like Tiggy to get to half court again, and then you can just rotate through it. It's like, well, maybe that's something we can start doing a little bit of. And I have by no means actually tried this drill. Give me time. I'll give it a crack. I'll let you know if it works because it'll be up on Talking Split. But maybe that's something we can do with our players, just to have them aware of, look, it's just because someone's open doesn't mean they're available, because that is an issue that a lot of our players do have. It's like, oh, no, that's the first person I saw, so they're going to get it. It's like, yeah, but you've put it into a situation where the only way they can catch that is facing away from the rim in the corner with two defenders running at them. So, yes, they were open then, but you've now put them in a worse situation. You're better off getting a five-second count on the baseline, like if that's what you're going to do. So I think there's ways that we can be a little bit creative with what we do, and it is. It's that understanding, where is your space? What do I need to go and do next?
I mean, you're talking about teaching scanning there, yep. You know, and it's such an important part of this topic, is the amount of times that we have poor pass catch turnovers because the passer was just looking at their teammate.
Yep.
They had no idea where the defense was. They just look at their teammate. Oh, they're open. Didn't see the player, you know, coming sprinting, you know, at full pace to shoot the gap. And then all of a sudden that pass is picked off and it's a layup. So I think anything that we're doing where we're working on our passing and catching, we're coaching the eyes and really helping the athletes be looking at the defense, not at their teammates,
yep,
is going to be beneficial in the long run. And just to build on that too, Rob, two things. One, I love the purposeful practice of that, yep, young person just taking that, grabbing a mate and working on that skill set on their own. Like, that's what our players need to be doing more often. Yep. We've gone away from that.
At the free throw line, preferably.
Yep.
Yep.
And then the other part is, just to relate back to another sport, American football, just to kind of round out the three footballs.
The Holy Trinity, as we call it.
The good quarterbacks do that. Yep. The good quarterbacks throw passes away from the defense, like especially when wide receivers or tight ends button hook back to the ball, they'll throw the ball to the shoulder that's away from the defense so that that receiver knows that's the way to turn, so that the ball's coming to the shoulder that they need to turn to try and, you know, get more yards after the catch. So
I can't remember if I said this on the podcast the other week or not, and apologies to anyone out there, because there are always people very prepared to remind me, hey, you said that, you know, 2 weeks earlier. So thank you to those people. But I was listening to watching a podcast that Jason Williams was on. And he was talking about when he used to play, one, phenomenal passer of the ball. And they're like, how did you become a good passer? And he's like, I worked out really quickly that I came from an area that it was, if you won, you stayed on. If you lost, you got off. And you had to hope that another team would pick you up to go and play with them on the next run. He's like, I worked out really quick that if I could get other people the ball in spots they wanted the ball, I would get picked a lot.
Love that.
Was how I had to figure out what comes next. And he's like, but I always had a rule that if I hit you on the full, you are open. He's like, that was how I worked as a point guard. He's like, if I've had to throw a bounce pass at you or anything like that, that means you shouldn't be shooting it. He's like, but you could have full faith that if I hit you on the full, on the hands, you are open, in which case you should shoot it. And he's like, and I played with some great shooters. He's like, I had Ray Allen, I had Redick, those sorts of guys as well. That was the rule. If I can hit you on the full with your hands, that means you're open and you should just shoot it. And it's like, geez, you are taking so many decisions away from shooters in that space. But how's the level to be able to read the D to know, hey, you have enough time to get that thing away. That is next level.
Amazing.
Genuinely next level that we're talking about here. So, yeah, it's what we're dealing with.
Skill level is going to drop heavily here, Rob. Story time. You'll know what I mean in a second. When I was playing for Nick Abdusevic.
Yep. Not quite the same conversation. We've That's gone from white chocolate to I only eat chocolate.
I've got some right here. No. I was playing in a position that was primarily a position that would find cutters. Okay. And I kept turning over the ball, trying to basically reverse it to the top of the 3-point line. And Nick A stopped it after probably the third time, and he goes, Nick, I'm going to show you what you look like. I wish we had video now to see it too. And he walked up to the brick wall and he started pushing against it, and he started getting frustrated at the brick wall that it wouldn't move. And he goes, that's what you look like when you're trying to do a pass.
It's also what Nick looks like as he's watching Nick try and make that pass.
100%. And then I started coaching. No. But the point of it was to make decisions. They're overplaying the pass. Sometimes we can't see the forest through the trees, and we're like, I need to get the ball here. And there's an open lane to pass on this side. Or let's say you're inbounding it and you're trying so hard to get the point guard open that the trail's just standing there open going, why can't he just throw it to the point guard? Like, we've also got to, with the scanning of the data, it's a massive point. Yeah. Well,
and how many point forwards do we now have in the game? There are so many bigger players, I'll say, for lack of a better term, that are actually capable of putting the ball on the floor. They're not, you know, completely incapable of this. Use them. Mm. Like, how many times do we have our junior athletes say, oh, you know, I'm undersized for the big, I'm not going to be a big, play me as a guard. Well, okay, here's your opportunity. On the ball reversal, that's you. Now you get to play as a guard, despite being the taller player that may have to defend a big or something like that, that might play in the high post or something like that. Well, here's your opportunity to be a guard.
Yeah, and this is a great prompt, you know, to our coaching choices, where, you know, we have a responsibility to create schemes that are going to give athletes options, right? That, like what Nick's talking about, it's like, okay, well, if you can't get it there because that's being taken away, well, our next progression is to get it there, and then that triggers this action and so on. So we want to have strategies and schemes that help the players be able to read the defense and choose different options. But then the other choice, and we do this quite a bit, is where we say, you have to get it there. You're not allowed to use the other options today. So it's on that guy to get open. And it's on you as a passer to be able to get it there, because we need to work on, you know, the skill set that's coming with being able to feed the pinch post or kick the ball ahead or play through the four, whatever it may be.
And it's amazing how often that happens. The level of defense goes up because they know the ball is coming here. Right. I have to try and do everything I can. It's like, well, great. If you can play against us at practice when they know the ball is coming here, you'll be fine in a game when, you know, the D may or may not know where the ball is going, but you've already seen a higher level of D in that. So I think there's a lot to take away from that in particular. Baselines and sidelines. How many should you have? Like, Coops, how deep are we going on this one?
So in the past, I've only had one.
Yep.
So, and then what I tried to do is to have one that is the same alignment, which is very similar movement that can be run against a man in a zone. So I'm not having to have two plays, a man play and a zone play, that basically the same movement and concepts work against a man and a zone. And then if I'm at a higher level, I would maybe have a short clock option. So something where, you know, the 4 seconds or less, you know, we need to be able to get a shot. But yeah, the sideline would basically just get us into our action. So we run a, you know, like a wedge screen at the moment, you know, kick ahead wedge. Basically, the sideline that we've been using is just a wedge screen. So we inbound it and we're straight into our action. So it's one screen. It opens up some options. We're into it. Players know what we're running. Basically, that's no sideline out of bounds because it's still just an action we've already run. Yep. And then I would do the same thing on the baseline.
Yep. Nick, are you any different?
No, very similar. I mean, I guess it depends on the age group as well, like Coop said. But, you know, under 12s, obviously, you would have probably one sideline and one baseline.
If you get a sideline in with under 12s, you are a genius.
You're doing really well, right? Yeah. But I actually just, I know, a little bit off topic, but I stole this idea from you, Rob, where I would call it bass, and if I had another one, it would be bass again, which was just a nice, and the kids loved it because, yeah, we're tricking them. Like, yeah. Yeah, like they used to love that, so they buy into it a little bit more as well.
Oh, the psychological warfare with under 12 kids is brilliant. Yeah, fun. Like it's
they love it.
Yeah, I remember we had two baseline plays with an under 12s group and like both out of a box set. And if we called a colour, it was one thing. If we called a number, it was the other thing. And I remember the coach coming, like we were just chatting after the game. He's like, man, how many baseline head of bands you got? There was a blue, there was a pink, there was a red, there was a green. I'm like, brother, same one every time. Like they just call it different colour and that's just the one. Like it's great fun tricking people.
Love it.
It is, but it's a good point what you do with your program where you incorporate what you run on the floor of the sideline. I remember seeing Darren Perry used to do something very similar at Dandenong where he would have all his offensive sets with stagger screens and stuff and he would just run the same things. But just the inbounder would start it like instead. So we didn't have to reteach a lot as well. It's a really good idea to put an inbounds play in and make sure that the pass is comfortable. Hey, I know this. I'm just off the court instead of on the court, right?
That's it. Yeah, all you've done is change the position. I think the other thing too that's really important to remember, especially for our younger teams and our younger coaches, is the priority of your sideline and end line is to get the ball in. You know, it's all well and good for us three to sit here and talk about, you know, using our staggers and our wedge and we want to get this shot and then this and all that sort of stuff. At the end of the day, get the ball in.
Yep. I'll counter that. Are you better off getting a 5-second count rather than making a fairly average pass?
Always.
Yeah, 100%. I'm the same. Like if it looks dicey, I'd rather you just tuck that thing under your arm and go, yep, my turnover, rather than throw something that can put the other team in transition.
Well, especially, that's the only thing to think of. Especially now that you guys know I'm such a defense-heavy coach. Like I'm really like this like kind of like defensive mastermind that I trust our defense being set up rather than trying to play against a live ball turnover.
Oh, I like what you've done with that. But it's a point you made earlier, actually, Coos, when we were talking about like inbounding the ball. How often does the baseline out of bounds or the sideline out of bounds have the ball on their head to throw it? And so, yes, you can throw chest passes, but that's probably, you're going to have to throw it through two or three people to try and get it there. So their ability to throw it outside their body, like whip something off a shoulder, those types of things as well, or even just throw an overhead pass that gets where it needs to get to. Like you're probably not throwing too many overhead passes off the baseline, but probably off a sideline you would have to in that space. So you do actually have to teach different passing angles, like what happens next, where's your safety out. Like I get really nervous personally off a baseline with that our outlet safety is to throw it back to like the high out. It's like, oh, I don't love this at all. Like this worries me a lot. So I think anything where you can get big to small screening, where you can get mismatches, you can punish people that do want to switch out, because we do see that a lot. Like it's, you would very rarely see an end of game situation where the instruction on the defensive end is not switch everything. Mm-hmm. You will get some of the better teams that are like, hey, we're going to pre-switch this so that, you know, big take the guard take the big, so that when that action happens, you can switch and you're all good to guard your spot. But it is, like, you've got to get the ball in. Like, and if you can't get the ball in, well, don't worry about the rest of it.
Do any of your inbounds plays, your sideline out of bounds, do you ever have the cutters leading to half court instead of leading towards the bus? Because I was a bit, like, I'm OCD with that stuff because I'm like, it's not going to happen to me no matter what. Even if I turn it over right near the baseline, then I have a chance here. So I would send most of it, I'm probably telling my secrets here, but, like, I would send most of them towards the baseline just out of fear that someone would pinch it and get out on a transition lamp. Do you run any? And if so, how do you make sure limit the possibility of that happening?
I get real nervous off the sidelines, just from where you have to inbound the ball now. So remember when that rule first came in? Like you used to be able to, I think you used to be able to inbound in the backcourt. Like you had your choice of
You can still have the choice in the last 2 minutes. Yep. And now also after a made basket, if you do advance it, you can actually choose which side of the floor.
That's true.
Yeah.
But there was a rule once, because I remember having an East Coast challenge where I think you maybe used to take it from half court line and we would send like three players into the back court. And it's like, hey, we'll play one-on-one like down that end if we have to. But now I don't love where we have to win the ball from now, because I get real nervous about anything that's coming towards half court. That's prime stealing territory. Anything that goes down towards the corner is prime trapping territory. Anything that goes to the other side of the floor is like, well, we can pinch that. I don't love advancing the ball now unless I really, like a late clock, you don't have much of a choice. Like, I get it. But I'd probably rather keep it in the backcourt a little bit on my end. I don't know. What about you, Coops?
Yeah, if it's heavily clock dependent, but I much prefer to have it in the backcourt and have the space, and especially, you know, being able to run the baseline and just open the floor up a little bit, maybe a pass over the top, something like that. That's, you know, just going, everything's going towards our basket. If I have advanced it, I want to try and get three options. So the one, we'd have one to the corner, we'd have one to the basket, one to the ball. So we got trying to maximize things heading towards us, and then I would still have one option heading back and away as like a fail safe if we needed to. But the idea is that we're looking towards our rim first. I think the other thing, just going back to what you were talking about, Rob, as well, about the inbounder, and every Friday night, if you go and watch when the ref hands the ball to that person, they're naturally going to put the ball above their head. You watch them, they take it, and they'll just put the ball above their head straight away. So what do a lot of defensive strategies now incorporate? Like if you've got a 7-footer, I don't know if you guys, obviously, Nick, you're in the environment where you have that. The amount of times...
You're on 7-footer and under 14.
Yeah.
Look at Chico having Joe Perry. My God.
It was handy, I won't lie.
How many times did you put him on the inbounder?
Yeah, there was a few times where we just stick him there just to, because even if he didn't get a deflection, the pass was so wide that someone would go get it, right?
Yep. So just that ability, you know, playing, you know, in that small box of, you know, of how much you can move and the passing angles from the inbound, like that's a skill within itself. So by starting with a ball above your head, you don't really have anywhere to go. So it'd be better to see players take the ball from the ref and drop down into a stance and start thinking about pivots and fakes.
And take a step back, please.
Yeah.
You don't need to hug the sideline when you're inbounding the ball. That's one of my pet peeves for inbounding. Took us an hour to get there, but we got there. But
No. It's valid. Like, I know if it's different numbering now, so I don't even know what court it is. But the old court 3 at Diamond Valley, like if you were on defense on that thing, like if you had like a size 11 foot, like you were standing on the court on that sideline if you were on the bench side. So like that was one of the areas that you could really trap hard in. Or even like the old Werribee court. Like remember when you used to first walk in that first one there? We played an under 12s game on there and we turned that thing over like it was going out of fashion. I didn't know any better, and I was walking out and saw Paul Jones. This is, you know, he was walking in. I'm like, man, we coughed that thing up religiously on that thing. He's like, yeah, you do realize the court's not full size. Yeah. I'm like, well, now I do. Yeah. Like, of course, we had no space to cut into. Like, it made a lot more sense. But it is like your point is valid. Take a step back and open up some angles that maybe you aren't available to you if you stand right on the sideline.
Yeah,
it's
a great point. Yeah,
have to be very mindful of that. All right, coaches. Hopefully that does help. We'll jump into our social split talk for the week.
Something to post on Facebook. Let's go.
It's like me on Twitter.
All right. So we got Roger Federer this week talking us through our social split talk.
In tennis, perfection is impossible. In the 1,526 singles matches I played in my career, I won almost 80% of those matches. Now, I have a question for you. What percentage of points do you think I won in those matches? Only 54%. In other words, even top-ranked tennis players win barely more than half of the points they play. When you lose every second point on average, you learn not to dwell on every shot. You teach yourself to think, okay, I double-faulted, it's only a point. Okay, I came to the net and I got passed again, it's only a point. Even a great shot, an overhead backhand smash that ends up on ESPN's top 10 playlist, that too is just a point. So, and here's why I'm telling you this. When you're playing a point, it has to be the most important thing in the world, and it is. But when it's behind you, it's behind you. This mindset is really crucial because it frees you to fully commit to the next point and the next point after that with intensity, clarity, and focus. The truth is, whatever game you play in life, sometimes you're going to lose a point, a match, a season, a job. It's a roller coaster with many ups and downs. And it's natural when you're down to doubt yourself and to feel sorry for yourself. And by the way, your opponents have self-doubt too. Don't ever forget that. But negative energy is wasted energy. You want to become a master at overcoming hard moments. That is, to me, the sign of a champion. The best in the world are not the best because they win every point. It's because they know they lose again and again and have learned how to deal with it. You accept it, cry it out if you need to, and then force a smile. You move on, be relentless, adapt and grow, work harder, work smarter. Remember, work smarter.
Roger Federer, probably, I think, the greatest male tennis player, probably Serena, is the greatest female tennis player. I love that message. Like, all about the whole, you only win maybe 50%-ish, but you can still win 80% of your matches. You can lose a quarter in basketball, but you can still win the game. When he says it's only a point is at the foul line, and we need those points at the foul line. So please make those if you can.
But be a valuable goldfish.
Yeah, it really is.
Like, yeah.
Full
yeah.
lasso. Yeah. It's
Stoicism, Rob.
Oh, I do have that button on here. I haven't used it for a while.
You knew Marcus Aurelius.
My bad. Sorry, I'm out of practice.
That's all right. No, I need to be doing it more. I need to give you the reps. Yeah, so that's on me. That's on me as a coach. Yeah,
It's just a drop.
That was Stoicism. It's the dichotomy of control. You don't control what's happened in the past. It's already happened. The only thing you can control is the present, and that's the next point, or it's the next possession. And it's that ability to just keep your mind where you have the ability to influence or execute or have joy or whatever your purpose is. And I love hearing elite athletes and elite people like Federer talk about stoic principles that way and how valuable they are to athletes and coaches.
Yeah, have you ever read The Inner Game of Tennis?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't read it for maybe 20 years, and it was one of the first books that got recommended to me when I was coaching. It's like, hey, get on this, and it's, yes, it's tennis talk, but it is all about the mental side of it, and like you would learn more out of that than you would go into like near on any coaching clinic, I reckon. It's just the mental side of what you go through and how you're playing against yourself, but you also need belief in yourself, but what's going on the other side, is there a game within the game. It's a fascinating read. It's an unofficial book club.
Yep.
Jump on The Inner Game of Tennis. But it is, like, I love listening to Federer talk about it. And just it's like, oh, it's just a point. Like, ultimately, how many times would he have walked into a tournament and not been the highest ranked player there? Like, it would have been few and far between. Like, Nadal coming through at the end with him, Djokovic maybe. Maybe Sampras at the start, depending on, I don't even know if their careers crossed over or not, but he always would have walked in as one of the better two or three and would have been potentially ranked playing against someone that is ranked 197th in the world who fires down an ace and it's like, oh, it's a point.
And you could definitely see that when he used to play. Yep. Nothing fazed him, did it?
Never blew up.
So he's a man of his words as well.
But if you go back, he actually wasn't like that at the beginning of his career. He was famously hot-headed and really struggled with this. And so the fact that he worked through it to become the person that you're talking about, this stoic character that was able to have such mental fortitude and resilience is a credit to him and should be an example to all athletes that and coaches, if you're struggling with emotions and reactions and living in the past a little bit, that it takes time, but it takes effort and you can change.
Yep, absolutely. Coaches, that is us for the week. Coops, Nick, thank you very much for jumping in. We'll be back next week. As always, good luck.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.